Yeah, and happy Resurrection Day. We were talking a little bit before the before class started about how what's the most amazing thing that God has done. I mean, he's saved us. We've been delivered from our sins through faith. And then he sanctifies us. We grow in our faith over time. But when we're glorified in the future, you know, and we have no sin nature, what will that be like? Just imagining that and thinking about that and meditating on that. That's what we're looking forward to ultimately. Does it make it weird that we're looking forward to our death? Probably the world would say yes. But we are look forward to that next step in our existence when we're in his presence and we're perfected. What an awesome thing. Okay, yeah, the book of Genesis, just a reminder that we're in that and we're coming to a close. That major section in Genesis, the Toledot of Terah. Remember, Genesis is divided into a number of Toledots, generations of. And the generations of Terah, Toledot of Terah, began back in Genesis chapter 11, verse 27. And it covers primarily the life of Abraham. And it runs until Genesis chapter 25, verse 11, where Abraham dies. So we're getting close to the end of the saga of Abraham. And in Genesis chapter 22, verse 20 through 24, we looked at a couple of weeks ago, we begin this transition. You know, we're getting towards the end of this Toledot of Terah, the life of Abraham, and we're going to transition to the next generation, to Isaac and Rebekah. And that sort of began back in the end of chapter 22, where we saw the Nahor branch of the Terah family, the focus on Bethuel, the son of Nahor, and Milcah, and the father of Rebekah. So we saw that kind of just inserted there at the end of chapter 22, but it's looking forward to what's to come. Chapter 23, we looked at last week, continues the account of the generational transition. We saw the death and burial of Sarah at the age of 127. And so Abraham would be 137 in chapter 23, and Isaac would have been 37. So we saw Abraham then purchase the burial site of Machpelah to bury Sarah. Again, a demonstration of Abraham's faith. This is my homeland now. I've been here for 62 years. I don't own any land yet, but I know it's coming because God's promised it. So now he has his first actual deed to a piece of land in the land of Canaan. And then chapter 24 is going to continue the theme of transition. And that's where we're at today. And we'll look at how Isaac's wife is selected. Again, the son of Abraham and Sarah. We'll see the providential working of God in the circumstances, you know, with his faithful servant, Abraham. So pick up in chapter 24, verse 1. Now Abraham was old, advanced in age, and Yahweh had blessed Abraham in every way. So he's going to be 140 years old here, Abraham is. He was 100 when Isaac was born. We know that from back in Genesis chapter 21. Then when we get to Genesis chapter 25, Isaac is going to be 40 years old when he marries Rebekah. So we know that Abraham at this point is 140 years old. And his life has been characterized by divine blessing. And he's lived a long life, okay, by post-flood standards. You know, before the flood, they were living 900-plus years. That quickly diminished. Now, at the time of Abraham, 140 years would be considered divinely blessed. So again, he's been blessed by a long life, by peace and prosperity, accumulated wealth and possessions. We've looked a lot at the, you know, he was a man of great wealth at that time. In chapter 13, verse 2, it says, now Abraham was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold. So he had all sorts of resources available to him. Okay, so verse 2. And Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who ruled over all that he owned, please place your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by Yahweh, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live, but you will go to my land and to my kin and take a wife for my son Isaac. So it's time, you know, time is passing. Sarah is dead. Abraham's advanced in age. It's time to secure a wife for his son. You know, parents played more of a role in securing spouses for their children back in that day. So it's time to move forward with that. This cure a wife for his beloved son Isaac, the son of promise. And that word son is going to be used. It's very emphatic here in verse 3 and verse 4 and verse 6 and verse 7 and verse 8. And then get towards the end of the chapter, it's going to be used again. But this is my son. This is my son. We need to get things done right. And so he involves his most trusted servant. And we've seen one named servant of Abraham's back in chapter 15, verse 2, Eliezer. That's probably the same guy that we talked about back there, where the servant is really in charge of things. He's like the foreman. He's like the CEO of the company sort of idea here. But he's going to trust this man with this important task, this immense responsibility of finding a wife for his son, Isaac. And again, the wife cannot be Canaanite. Okay, she has to come from Abraham's family. So this is going to involve a trip back to Mesopotamia to find a wife. And again, this importance of marrying within the family of God's chosen people, God's covenant people. And in the Mosaic Law, later it's going to prohibit marrying outside of the nation of Israel, again, because of the fear of religious apostasy. Once you get out of the family, who knows what kinds of bad things are going to end up coming into the family. It's very critical here to find the right wife for Isaac. And then at the end of verse 2, he's before giving the servant his instructions, he tells him we're going to perform this, kind of deeply solemn and personal gesture of putting your hand under your thigh. And that seems a little strange to us. But cutting a covenant, chopping an animal in two and walking between them seems pretty strange too. But this would be consistent with practices in the ancient Near East at that time and oath-taking practices. And the exact symbol of, the hand under the thigh is debated, but generally it's agreed that it's a tie to, procreative power and posterity. Abraham's the head of the family. They're acknowledging that, and the line needs to continue. From him down to his son Isaac, and that continuation of the promised line of the covenant nation requires that the right wife be chosen as well. So we need to preserve the covenant line. And a picture of trust between the parties. This, if it's Eliezer, he'd been with Abraham, for 62 years running his business. So there's trust between these two men. And that would be a similar thing too, as a picture of trust, a willing submission, a binding obligation on the part of this servant. And, we sometimes, an intimate touch to seal a deal, a handshake or a hug. Well, I used to do with my kids when I wanted to make sure they understood what I was saying and they would follow through, as I'd take them by the head and I'd bring their face up to mine. I'd look them in the eyes. I'd go, "You understand what I'm saying, right? This is, and kind of the same type of deal. Just this very intimate interaction here between Abraham and this servant. Then in verse 3, they're going to swear by Yahweh, the God of heaven and the God of earth. I mean, he's the sovereign ruler over all. Heaven and earth, what else is there? There's nothing. That's all inclusive. And again, that adds again to the seriousness of the task at hand. This swearing by the God of heaven and the God of earth, this is going to happen. It's a critical task. Then verse 4, it's a very difficult assignment, because he's going to have to go back to Mesopotamia, this servant is. And that's 500 miles. We talked about that a little bit when Abraham came from Mesopotamia. But it's going to take 5, 6, 7, 8 weeks of travel, depending on various factors. But it's a long trip. It's like, I think somebody was talking about, it's like going from Omaha to Scotts Bluff by foot with no rest stops. It's a long and arduous, difficult journey. And then when he gets there, what does he have to do? He has to find a woman. He has to convince her to come back that 500 miles to a land she doesn't know to marry a man she hasn't seen. Okay, so a very difficult task here. So I like verse 5. And the servant said to him, Abraham, "Suppose the woman is not willing to follow me to this land. Should I indeed take your son back to the land from where you came?" And Abraham said to him, "Beware, lest you take my son back there." So, the servant's thought is, maybe it would be helpful if I took Isaac with me so I could introduce them and get her to come back. That might make things a little more a little easier, a little more certain, you know, but Abraham is like emphatic, beware, no, you know, Isaac cannot go back there. Can't take a chance on Isaac leaving the promised land, because then he might not come back. And God's promises are tied to the land of Canaan. So it's beware, you know, you cannot do that. That cannot happen. He cannot go. Okay, verse 7. Yahweh, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my kin, and who spoke to me and who swore to me, saying, to your seed I will give this land, he will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this oath of mine. Only do not take my son back there. So again, you know, Abraham's unshakable faith. You know, he's convinced that God is going to provide. You know, as long as the servant is faithful, the success of the mission is God's responsibility. Okay, God is going to intervene here. He anticipates, you know, God's direct guidance. His angel is going to go, and he's going to do the work. You just be faithful in your task and chore. As some commentators felt that this angel mentioned here is likely the angel of the Lord, the angel of Yahweh, the pre-incarnate Christ. Maybe, maybe not. But the key idea here is God is taking the lead. Abraham is convinced that God will ensure the success of this mission. Okay, so verse 9. So the servant placed his hand, and then in verse 8, you know, and if it fails, you're off the hook. Okay, so you just be faithful, do what you're supposed to do. If the mission isn't successful, then you're out of the oath. So you've been released from the oath. So verse 10. Then the servant, okay, verse 9. So the servant placed his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter. So again, the oath is completed, and the slave accepts this responsibility to go to Mesopotamia to find a wife for Isaac. So verse 10, then the servant took 10 camels from the camels of his master, and he went with all kinds of good things of his master's in his hand. So he arose and went to Mesopotamia to the city of Nahor. So again, he makes that 500-mile journey to the homeland of Abraham's relatives. You know, they left Ur, they went up to Haran and northern Mesopotamia. Again, a long and difficult journey. Really no details of the trip here. And then the city of Nahor is probably not far from Haran, or Haran, depending as people pronounce it different. Probably not far from Haran, which is where Abraham and his family lived when they left Ur, went up to northern Mesopotamia, and lived in Haran, which is where Abraham left to come down to the promised land. So Haran and Nahor probably are close together. And again, it bears the name, Nahor bears the family name of Abraham's brother and their grandfather. So Terah's dad was Nahor, and then Abraham has a brother, Nahor. And so the city bears that same name. Some equate Nahor with Haran. So you're reading different commentators, there's different, you know, ideas. The Nahor and Haran were the same town, just with different names, or the name had changed. And then some say that Nahor actually isn't a town, that it is the site, you know, it's a name, family name, and not really the town. I think it's best Nahor is a separate town, not the same as Haran, but in the general vicinity of where Haran was. Again, it's one of those things where you don't want to major on the minors. It's kind of irrelevant, but when you read a commentary that has 32 pages on, you know, where was this, then you're kind of getting lost in the details there. Hey, but he takes these 10 camels, and what he takes with him is going to be reflective of Abraham's extensive wealth. You know, God's blessing on his life, the wealth that he has. Some of that wealth is going with the servant up to Mesopotamia. Some talked about the size of the entourage. How big was the group that went there? We only see the servant. But if there's 10 camels and you need one camel or one servant to handle each camel, and then you also maybe need some protection from, you know, you've got a lot of valuables. You got to have some protection. There's general agreement that probably 15 to 30 people accompanied the servant on this trip. So there would have been a group of people going. And again, Mesopotamia, depending on translation you have. If you have an NIV or an NA, I think it's, yeah, NIV translates Mesopotamia as Aram Naharaim. So depending on the translation you have, that's a literal Hebrew word. So, but generally it's translated Mesopotamia, but it's also literally Aram Naharaim, which means Aram of the two rivers. And where does Mesopotamia lie? Between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. So that's why that word is in there. So verse 11. And he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at evening time, the time when the women go out to draw water. So it's kind of the standard would be there's a well outside the city, and you go in the cool of the evening to bring the water back. You know, you got to carry a lot of water. And poor women, they're the ones that got, this was their task typically, was to draw water for the family. And verse 12, and he said, O Yahweh, so now the servant is going to pray. And he said, O Yahweh, the God of my master Abraham, please cause this to happen before me today and show loving kindness to my master Abraham. So again, the servant, he knows that the only way the mission is going to be successful is through divine provision. You know, he's in the city now. He knows nobody. How's he going to find a wife for Isaac? So he prays to Yahweh God to intercede, you know, and show your loving kindness to my master. I like how he focuses on, you know, don't show your loving kindness to me. Show it to my master. I'm here on my master's behalf. Please, Lord, intervene on his behalf. And that word loving kindness, Hebrew word is hased. It's only used a couple of times in Genesis, but it becomes a very common description of God's love for his people, his covenant keeping, loyal, steadfast love. So it becomes a very much used word later on in the Old Testament, but only a couple of times in Genesis. Some translations, if you have NIV or New King James, they translate loving kindness, hased, as just kindness. But I think that doesn't capture the weight of the word. Loving kindness is a much better translation. So verse 13, again, he continues his prayer. Behold, I am standing by the spring of water, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now, may it be that the young woman to whom I say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and she says, drink, and I will give water to your camels to drink also, may she be the one whom you have decided for your servant Isaac. And by this I will know that you have shown loving kindness to my master. So again, the servant here in his prayer suggests a course of action. You know, if this happens, then I'll know that this is the right person. This is how I can be directed to the right person, the woman to be Isaac's wife. So verse 15, and before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, was coming out with her jar on her shoulder. So the plan is going to be blessed. The servant's suggested plan is going to be blessed by God with success. And you know, Rebekah, he just finishes his prayer and boom, here comes this woman down to draw water. Again, God working out his providential purposes using the prayers and activities of his people. I think that's really a key thing to remember in this section. You know, we're not to be passive in carrying out the plans and purposes of God. Okay, we're involved in prayer. How does God work in this world? Through the prayers of the saints. That's how he's chosen to do it. He doesn't need us in any way, but he's chosen to use us and our intercession to bring about his plans and purposes. I know there was always a saying that said, you know, let go and let God. Well, that's true in a sense, but it's get busy and let God. We're not just to let go, sit down, and kick back in the recliner, although that sounds kind of fun. But our job is to be busy on our knees praying. So we, in a sense, don't let go and let God. We get busy and let God work through us to accomplish his plans and purposes. And then we have in verse 15, now the servant doesn't know this yet, doesn't know Rebekah's lineage, but we do, okay? And we saw it back in the previous chapters as well, this Nahor branch of the Terah family. And I did kind of put it up here. This is just the genealogy of Terah through Genesis chapter 24, there's going to be a lot more stuff going on in the genealogy as we continue to work through Genesis. But we had Terah, and remember, Terah's father was Nahor. So Nahor would be up here. And then we have Terah, and then Terah had the three sons, Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. And we know that Haran had Milcah and Lot. These are things that we've learned so far as we've walked through these chapters in Genesis, that Haran had two children, Milcah and Lot, and Nahor had a son, Bethuel, and then Abraham has Ishmael and Isaac. Again, just so far in Genesis. We're going to add more to this as we go on. So here we have Haran had Milcah, and Milcah is going to marry Nahor and have this man, Bethuel. Okay, so we have this mixing of the generations, an uncle and a niece intermarrying. And I kind of did the colors like John. We have the first generation is blue, the next generation is red, and the next generation is green, and the next generation is black. So we see the generations kind of unfolding through here, and the mixing of the generations as there's these intermarriages, which we've talked about before at this time. There was intermarriage between close relatives. It wasn't considered anything unusual. So Milcah marries Nahor, her uncle. So, I mean, you say that, and it sounds kind of weird to us, but again, back in the day, it wouldn't have been. And then they have Bethuel, and then Bethuel has Rebekah and another son named Laban, who we'll talk about here shortly. And then Rebekah marries up a generation, is going to end up marrying Isaac. So this would be, if I understand it right, and I'm not super good at this, but it would be a first cousins once removed, because it's a different generation. So Isaac and Rebekah would be cousins, but it would be first cousins once removed because it's a generation down. I get a little lost in explaining that, but that's how it was explained to me by somebody who supposedly knows. So, and then we're going to have intermarriage between these families again, because Jacob is going to end up marrying Leah and Rachel, who are sons of Laban, Rebekah's brother. And again, we'll talk about Laban here pretty soon. So we kind of have... And then remember Sarah, I didn't put her on here, but Terah also had Sarah, Abraham's wife. So it was half brother, half sister. So a lot of interconnections here by the time Jacob has his 12 sons. The Haran branch of the family has intermarried with the Nahor branch of the family, which has intermarried with the Abraham branch of the family, who had intermarried with the Sarah branch of the family. So by the time we get to the sons of Israel, all the descendants of Terah have genetic contribution to that family. So anyway, we'll leave that there. My mind kind of gets lost as I walk through some of that, so that's why I needed to have it there, kind of. Usually the boards are for my benefit more so than anybody else's, but just a very interesting family mix here. So let's go back to Genesis 24. So again, verse 15, and before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, was coming out with her jar on her shoulder. Again, remember, the servant doesn't know this yet. We get a preview of what's going to happen here. 16, now the young woman was very beautiful in appearance, a virgin, and no man had known her. And she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. So that word young woman, I think it says girl in NASB. Some translations say woman. So young woman, girl, woman. The word can be used depending on its context in various ways. But I think here it's the best way to look at it is this is a mature young woman of marriageable age. Okay, she's ready to be married. Now that could be younger, 14, 13, that could be older, 20, 21, we don't really know, but somewhere in there. So again, it depends, that particular word depends on the context as to how you translate it. Okay, verse 17. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, please give me a little water to drink from your jar. So again, he's asking these questions that he had proposed to the Lord as a test. And she said, drink, my Lord. And she quickly lowered her jar to her hand and gave him a drink. Now when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw also for your camels until they have finished drinking. So he hurried and emptied her jar into the watering channel, ran again to the well to draw, and she drew for his camels. So this You know, exactly what he had unfolded in this proposal to God is happening. You know, this young, beautiful woman who's pure, she's hospitable and she's a hard worker. Again, she met the criteria outlined in verse 14. And, you know, I found this pretty fascinating. A camel can drink 25 gallons. It can drink up to 50 gallons of water if it's dehydrated. But typically at a drink, it's going to drink like 25 gallons. So how many camels were there? 10. So how many gallons of water did she have to draw to water the camels?
A lot.
A lot. So this was exhausting work. It would have taken, you know, if you use a 5-gallon bucket, it would have taken 50 draws of water. You know, my back hurts when I even thought about that. So again, you know, when the servant is proposing this test, this is like the chances of this test happening would only be through divine enablement, because no woman is going to come for a stranger and draw, you know, 2,000 pounds of water. You know, a ton of water is basically what it comes out to. But she says, she sees the 10 camels, let me draw for all your camels. So, you know, we're talking a long time. In verse 21, meanwhile, the man gazing at her in silence was gazing at her in silence to know whether Yahweh had made his journey successful or not. So that word to know, to learn, to determine, he's watching as this is going on. And he's like, wow, she just keeps going. You know, he didn't go over to help, but she just keeps going. Again, part of this divine test, is this the woman for my master's son, Isaac? You know, in verse 21, it's almost like it's too good to be true. You know, is this the one? I get here and all of a sudden, here's this woman and she's doing all these things. Again, he's not yet aware of her lineage, which is a critical piece of the puzzle. Yeah, but that's going to change here soon. Now, what happened, verse 22, that when the camels had finished drinking, so we're probably talking an hour, and it's a long time to draw all that water, the man took a gold ring weighing a half shekel and two bracelets for her wrists weighing 10 shekels in gold and said, whose daughter are you? You can just see him holding his breath like, whose daughter are you? Please tell me, is there a place for us to lodge in your father's house? So he demonstrates, you know, this demonstration of the immense wealth that Abraham had. This, you know, impressive, expensive gifts of jewelry. Ladies, don't get any ideas about getting this kind of stuff from us. But the general agreement, one shekel was 2/5 of an ounce. Today's price of gold is $4,900 an ounce. So this jewelry taken together would add up to over $21,000 in jewelry that that the servant gives to Rebecca, puts on her. That's a lot of pay for drawing water to feed the camels. And then he asks about her family and the possibility of lodging. And you can just, I don't know, it'd be fun to ask that servant someday. So what were you thinking when you were asking this question? You know, whose family are you? You know, please tell me, whose daughter are you? Verse 24. And she said to him, I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor. And she said to him, we have plenty of both straw and feed and a place to lodge. So, you know, hallelujah, she's a relative. He finds out that critical piece. And then Rebecca shows again her kindness. You know, we have lodging and we have food for your camels. You know, we're ready. We can provide this hospitality. Verse 26, then the man bowed low and worshiped Yahweh, and he said, blessed be Yahweh, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness and his truth toward my master. As for me, Yahweh has guided me in the way to the house of my master's brothers. So again, he just falls on his knees, and it's like, wow, this is like we said before, too good to be true. You know, my prayer has been answered. This critical mission is on its way to completion. And he just offers up praise and thanksgiving to God. You know, he recognizes the providence of God. God alone could have caused this to happen in the way it did. But he also acknowledges, like we talked about before, his role and responsibility in this. He had something that he had to do, and he was faithful in doing it. I like James chapter 5, verse 16, the effective prayer of a righteous man can accomplish much. Again, God works through his people to accomplish his plans and purposes. Also brought to my mind Philippians chapter 1, verse 19. You know, Paul's in prison, and he's not quite sure what's going to happen, but then he says in verse 19, he's confident he's going to be delivered, and then he says, through your prayers and the provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ. It's divine. It's God working through his people to accomplish what he wants, what he desires. So we have that combination of human responsibility and God's sovereignty. They go hand in hand. So we're not off the hook. What we do matters, okay? Because God uses it to accomplish his purposes. So verse 28, then the young woman ran and told her mother's household about these things. So she's like, I've got $20,000 worth of jewelry on me now. And this guy's praying to Yahweh about this prayer being answered. And she takes off for home. Like, I got to go tell Dad. You know, I got to go tell Mom about what is unfolding, you know, what has been unfolding here. So just this exuberant excitement. She runs home to tell the family. And, you know, the family, you know, probably no knowledge. They know little to nothing, not like a phone to call or anything. They know little to nothing about what happened to adventurous Abraham. You know, Abraham was the one who left Haran, you know, six decades earlier and went down to, of all places, the land of Canaan. You know, that was not an area of high reputation in the day that Abraham went down there. It'd be like us going to, where's a bad place? The Bronx or so, I don't know. But it's like, where'd they go? They went to Canaan. You know, so everybody's like, what's going on down there? And so there's, you know, all this excitement of long-lost relatives found. And not only that, but they're rich to boot. Look at all this, look at all these possessions that he's handing out. Okay, verse 29. Now Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban. And we saw Laban over here, again, the brother of Rebekah, son of Bethuel. Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban, and Laban ran outside to the man at the spring. So we're going to talk more about Laban in later chapters. He ends up not being a good guy, okay? You can kind of work things backwards from what we'll find out about his character later. He probably sees that wealth and goes, wow, we need to connect here. You know, he's going to be a greedy. His greedy character is going to shine through very thoroughly when we get to chapter 28 and 29 and stuff. He's going to deceive Jacob when Jacob comes for Leah and Rachel, or for Rachel. He's going to deceive Jacob at that time. So we'll see more about Laban later. But here he runs outside to the man at the spring in verse 30. Now it happened when he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's wrists, and when he heard the words of Rebekah, his sister, saying, this is what the man said to me, he came out to the man, and behold, he was standing by the camels at the spring. So again, he acts as the family representative, and he runs out, just like Rebekah ran in, he runs out to find this guy. You know, we got to get this guy before he leaves. You know, he might take off. We need to figure out what's going on here. And then he acts as the family representative and spokesman, which would be typical. You know, the dad or the brother, the oldest male would kind of represent the family. So that's consistent with those days. And he believes the story, you know, and he's excited. And he's going to invite then the man over to stay. You know, come in, blessed of Yahweh, verse 31. Why do you stand outside since I have prepared the house and a place for the camels? So come on over. So the man, verse 32, the man came into the house. Then Laban unloaded the camels, and he gave straw and feed to the camels and water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. And again, kind of one of those little details, depending on the translation you have. But the name Laban in verse 32, when it says, then Laban unloaded the camels, it's literally he. So it says he unloaded the camels. And most likely that would refer to Laban unloaded the camels. But it's also possible that the servant had to unload his own camels. That is a possibility. And some translations translate it in that way. But again, it's one of those little details. Yeah, it says he. Most likely, from my perspective, it makes sense that Laban unloaded the camels and consistent with the hospitality he was offering. But it's possible that the servant had to unload his own camels. So again, we don't want to get lost in those details, but it could go either way. So verse 33. Then food was set before him to eat. But he said, I will not eat until I have spoken my words. And he, this would be Laban, said, speak. So, you know, he's been traveling for multiple weeks. And finally, there's a home-cooked meal on the table. And I don't know, I'm afraid I might have eaten first. But this guy is a committed and faithful servant. You know, he's going to take care of business first before his own personal needs are met. So, and I think that's probably a good stopping point for us. We'll pick up and conclude again this account of the securing of Rebekah for Isaac's wife. So does anybody have any questions or any comments or any observations about this? I'm glad we have a car to drive when we have to go that far. Rest stops. So yeah, Denny. Yeah, I really appreciated that too about the servant, just about how his whole focus was on Abraham. He's doing this for Abraham. He's committed to doing this for Abraham. His prayers are focused on Abraham's benefit. It's just all service, you know, loving service towards another person. A great example for us to follow. Yeah, thank you. So anybody else have any comments or questions? Yeah, there are sites in the Promised Land, in the Holy Land, where certain events, you know, the likelihood, did this take place here? Yeah, we're 90% certain, and sometimes we're 50% certain, and sometimes we're 20% certain, but we know that it all happened in that general vicinity. So what, it'd be an awesome trip to Israel. That would be fun.
Well, we gotta get to the Ark.
Okay, well, happy Resurrection Day. It's good to see you all here. Let's close in prayer. Dear Father, again, we want to just praise you and thank you so much for this time together to worship together through our study of your word, to be encouraged by your word, and just, Father, to see how you've worked so diligently and so faithfully in the lives of your saints. We just ask you, Father, to help us live in a way that's pleasing to you out of love for you and what you've done for us. We just thank you for the salvation that you've given us. We thank you for the sanctification, the development that you're creating in our lives as we become more and more like Christ, as we come to know you better. And ultimately, Father, we just thank you for the glorification we'll experience when we see you face to face. We just love you and thank you and praise you and adore you. In Jesus' name, amen.